This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. And you know, I'm thinking it might not be too pleasant these days on the other side of the bench in the U.S. Supreme Court. Some historic arguments over some very basic questions of rights and responsibilities under the U.S. Constitution playing out in the opinions of the court. What is turning out to be the biggest year yet for the John Roberts Court is coming to a conclusion this week. Another 5-4 decision today. Narrow, divided, the dissents passionate. The divisions seem more bitter somehow. The latest decision? The court says that the federal government has no authority to specifically oversee voting districts with a history of voter discrimination without continued explicit congressional authorization. In a 5-4 split, the court has ruled against Attorney General Eric Holder in the important case of Shelby County, Alabama versus Holder. Section 4 of the Voting Rights Act is declared unconstitutional. And Shelby County and other so-called Section 4 districts will no longer have to be specially accountable to the federal government for their elections practices. This applies to 9 states and parts of 6 other states that have a history of racial discrimination. Chief Justice Roberts wrote the 5-4 decision. Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, in a dissent delivered from the bench, said, "By scrapping Section 4, the U.S. runs the risk of halting any progress that's already occurred in ending voter discrimination." Joining us now is Heather Gerken, professor of law at Yale Law School, where she specializes in election law. Welcome, Heather.
Hi, it's nice to be here.
How important is this focusing just on Section 4? The Roberts opinion seems to take pains to say that the overall notion of the Voting Rights Act is upheld.
It did say that, although anyone who knows about the Voting Rights Act knows that if you strike down Section 4, you've basically put a stake in the heart of Section 5, because Section 4 determines who is covered and who isn't. And without that coverage formula, Section 5 is a meaningless document.
Can't the Congress go back and reenact Section 4 tests for individual districts based on historical data?
Congress could go back, according to the court's opinion, and do that. The trouble is we've all spent a lot of time thinking about this. It's very hard to figure out the right coverage formula going forward, at least one that is politically viable, because it would require Congress to say some jurisdictions and not others have engaged in discrimination recently. And, you know, it's hard enough to get stuff passed in Congress, but to ask Congress to do that makes it even more difficult.
But isn't the court having trouble with the idea that the federal government gets to unilaterally do this once the clock is started? The burden is on those counties to show that they are, you know, sort of just like everywhere else in the United States?
Well, the federal government is entitled to do that because the provisions of the Constitution that matter here, the 14th and 15th Amendment, specifically gave Congress the power. And that's really the irony of this opinion. There was no question that the framers of the 14th and 15th Amendment intended for Congress, not the courts, but Congress, to decide how to enforce the amendments. And what the court did today was second-guess Congress's judgment on that.
Although, is part of this a well-established notion by Roberts and some of the other conservatives on the court that the Supreme Court resents having to do Congress's job in various decisions, this one being one example, and would prefer that Congress deal with this, not the court?
Well, Congress did deal with it, and the Roberts Court nonetheless second-guessed it. Congress amassed a lot of evidence. Now, you can have debates about whether it was good evidence or bad evidence, but Congress nonetheless did do its job. It amassed exactly the kind of record that the Supreme Court has repeatedly said it ought to amass. And what the Supreme Court did today was second-guess that based on its own view about whether the South is no longer the South.
So to be specific, or to be clear here, you are opposed to this decision.
Well, I will just say that I think that what the court asked of Congress was impossible. So what the court essentially said to Congress was, you need to prove to us that there is current discrimination going on that allows you to continue with Section 5. But the problem really for Congress was this. If Section 5 was working, you shouldn't find much evidence of discrimination. That's what it meant to be working. A friend of mine uses the comparison. It's like having a patient on Lipitor and looking at their cholesterol levels. The cholesterol levels may go down, but that doesn't mean you should stop the Lipitor. So the court was basically asking for Congress to prove something it couldn't prove, which is, if we didn't have Section 5 around, would there be a lot more discrimination? And since we lack a parallel universe to run the experiment, there wasn't much for Congress to do here.
Although you could make the same argument, not to be argumentative, about police action, that because we have these special sort of martial law provisions and there's no crime, that's not an argument for getting rid of police oversight here. The framers would have a real difficulty with the idea of open-ended martial law.
Well, I don't think we're quite at open-ended martial law. I mean, I will say that of course, you know, Congress has to think about it, and the court has to give it a certain amount of leeway. But the amount of leeway that the court gave to Congress this time is far less than it has in previous decisions. So what we saw today from the Supreme Court was a departure from its own precedent regarding the Voting Rights Act itself.
Before we go, and we're going to get some reaction from people on both sides of this question in just a moment, Heather Gerken, what does the 5-4 decision say about the precedent here?
Well, the 5-4 decision, I think, is the death knell, at least, of Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act as we currently see it. I think what the court has really done is put the ball in Congress's court, and we'll see if Congress has the ability to pass the legislation that we need to protect the voting rights of minorities across the country. You know, Congress hasn't been particularly good at passing anything of late, so I guess we'll see.
She specializes in election law at the Yale Law School. Heather Gerken is a professor there. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Let's get reaction now. Civil rights leader Julian Bond joins us, one of the founders of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee in the early 1960s that fought the early battles on voting rights. He later became head of the NAACP. He's now a professor at American University in Washington. Julian Bond, your dissent here.
Well, this strikes me as a terrible day for voting rights in the United States. What the court has done is can only be called retrenchment and backing away from the established way the country has decided to deal with discrimination at the voting booth. There's a proven record of discrimination in many states in this country. We could see during the last election these attempts at voter suppression nationwide in states both north and south. And so to imagine that this problem has been solved, or even more, to imagine that the Congress, which is so dysfunctional, could deal with correcting it, is just a myth. It's a dream. This is a bad, bad day for civil rights.
Also with us is John Nyman, the Solicitor General of Alabama, who wrote an amicus brief in support of Shelby County. John Nyman, your concurrence.
Well, I think it's important, John, to note that in some ways this decision was a lot more narrow than folks are going to portray it in the media. Shelby County had asked the court to adopt a very broad holding and say that Congress had no power to impose this particular remedy really anywhere in the United States, and that remedy is requiring state and local governments to pre-clear their laws with the federal government before those laws could go into effect. The court declined to adopt Shelby County's argument on that front, and that means that, at least for the time being, it's at least possible for Congress to protect voting rights in that same way. All that the court said in this case was that the current formula that Congress used to determine which states were covered and which states weren't wasn't really current. It was based on things that happened in the 1960s, awful things that justified the preclearance measure then. But the message to Congress was, look, if you think that it's sufficiently important to distinguish between states in this way, you need to come up with a formula that accounts for current realities.
Is there something cynical, though, about this decision in the sense that no one on the court probably expects Congress to either hear that message or take up the call to update the formula?
Gosh, I don't know. Most courts I am aware of do their own business, and they let Congress do theirs or legislatures do theirs. Certainly if I were on the court, my reaction here would be, look, all the advocates for Section 5 and Section 4, the coverage formula, are telling us that we should defer to what Congress does. That assumes that Congress is capable of doing things and making hard choices. Here, it simply needs to go back to the drawing board and make the hard choices that it's in the business of making.
All right, John Nyman. Julian Bond, John Nyman has a point here. Liberals often look at the court as a kind of a backstop for an intransigent Congress. It's up to Congress to do the work here, and it's not up to the court. What do you say to that?
Well, from time to time, I've looked to the Congress to do certain things, and from time to time, the Congress has done certain things. But if you look at Congress today, you can't expect it to do much of anything. It does almost nothing, and to think that it would address this question that's been put before them now, I just think is whistling at the moon.
Is that a separate argument, though, perhaps a separate challenge to be brought to the court, different than what Shelby County tried to say in this particular lawsuit?
It may well be a separate challenge, but it's a challenge nonetheless.
John Nyman says this is a more narrow decision than the media is going to make out. Do you go along with that? And if it's broader, how would you say it's broader?
It's more narrow than Shelby County wanted. Shelby County wanted to hear him discuss it something much broader, much more sweeping. And he didn't get that. But he got something which is just as debilitating to the Voting Rights Act as it possibly could be. To get rid of Section 4, you're really getting rid of Section 5. And Section 5 is the heart of the Voting Rights Act. So I'm sure he's disappointed and wanted something more, but I think he got more than enough.
John Nyman, why don't you describe your view of the relationship between Section 4 and Section 5? Two commentators on the program have now said that without Section 4, Section 5 is essentially a symbolic abstraction.
Well, John, I think that's right, although I'm not even sure we have to say it's a symbolic distraction or abstraction. The way that the law is written, unless there is a coverage formula in place, Section 5 simply does not operate. So that's definitely clear. But the point is that Congress could go back to the well and amend Section 4, come up with criteria that may cover other states that haven't traditionally been covered, but perhaps in Congress's view need to be covered.
So John, I mean, I appreciate your candor here. You're actually following the logic on some level of Ruth Bader Ginsburg in her dissent, that if Congress does nothing, this is a nullification of the entire law.
It certainly means that Section 5 itself does not operate in the jurisdictions that were covered before the current coverage formula was declared unconstitutional. Now, there are other provisions in the Voting Rights Act, including Section 2, that apply nationwide and will continue to protect voting rights of all Americans. But as of now, Section 5 itself doesn't have any effect.
John Nyman is the Solicitor General of Alabama. He wrote an amicus brief in support of Shelby County in the decision today in front of the Supreme Court. Julian Bond, we'll leave it with you. John Nyman's argument there, I suspect, is behind your statement, this is a bad day for voting rights in the United States.
Exactly so. He and I agree.
And that's, I would suspect, to be a surprise today.
It's a surprise to me.
All right. Julian Bond is the former chair of the NAACP, now a professor at American University. In the 1960s, he helped create and lead the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, which fought some of the early battles in voting rights in the United States. Thanks to both of you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So we'd love to hear your response, your views on all of this. 877-8-MY-TAKE or post a comment at thetakeaway.org. President Obama weighed in on this decision earlier today. Here's his statement. I'm deeply disappointed with the Supreme Court's decision today. For nearly 50 years, the Voting Rights Act, enacted and repeatedly renewed by wide bipartisan majorities in Congress, has helped secure the right to vote for millions of Americans. Today's decision invalidating one of its core provisions upsets decades of well-established practices that help make sure voting is fair, especially in places where voting discrimination has been historically prevalent. I am calling on Congress, the president said, to pass legislation to ensure every American has equal access to the polls. My administration will continue to do everything in its power to ensure a fair and equal voting process. A lot of news there, a lot of reaction. The Supreme Court's term, the Roberts Court's term, comes to a conclusion this week. More decisions tomorrow coming up. A member of the WikiLeaks team on the case of Edward Snowden and why Ecuador is the place to be for leakers like Julian Assange. That's next.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Jeffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at The New Yorker. So join us every week on The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.